Good morning. It took 6 months to gather information for a long-term response to the Every Student Succeeds Act. Now the governor's blueprint is being merged with the Department of Education strategic plan. We'll talk with Daryl Galera, head of the blueprint team and now also on the Board of Education. And we'll get an update on the proposed changes to the food safety codes with Peter Oshiro of the State Department of Health. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk. The Gay Men's Chorus of Honolulu's holiday concert is entitled Way Too Merry, and Chorus President Butch Meredith will be with us in our studio. And a new documentary celebrates the memory of one of the last true movie stars, Toshiro Mifune, The Last Samurai.
That's the conversation for this Friday, December 9th. It all starts right after a look at these headlines. Good morning and welcome to an Aloha Friday on The Conversation, and I would suppose everywhere else throughout Hawaii. I'm Beth Ann Costello.
Let's hope so.
Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann. We're hearing a lot more about food safety these days. It's probably good that we are, yeah?
Well, we've had good reason.
You know,
we just think back to this last year and several of the stories that continued to populate the year.
Exactly.
And now it looks like there are going to be some changes to the food court. So, you know, we've all come to recognize those stoplight placards in the windows of restaurants in the state. And, of course, food safety, as we just mentioned, has been one of the ongoing stories of this year. Today on Kauai, the State Department of Health will hold its last public hearing about changes to the food safety codes. Peter Oshiro is the Environmental Health Program Manager for the Sanitation and Food and Drug Branch of the Department of Health. He joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for having me here.
Thanks for joining us. Now, looking at the proposed amendments, you know, there's one that includes making sure that food safety education is a requirement for people in charge at all food establishments. Peter, one would have thought that that would have kind of been there already. What's the difference between this and what has been?
Again, that's a really, really good point. When we passed the new food regulations in 2014, what we did was we adopted the model food code, the 2009 edition of the FDA model food code, and that includes the provision where mandatory food safety education is required. At that time, my biggest focus was trying to rebuild the food safety program. So the focus was on trying to increase revenues to our program so we could hire more staff to make more efficient and frequent inspections of food establishments. So what happened is we quadrupled the permit fees on industry. We introduced that stoplight placarding program, which is a very high-profile way of telling the public what our inspectors see after an inspection has been done. And we also introduced public website where all our inspections are now posted immediately up on a public website that everyone also has access to. I made a calculated decision at that time that I didn't want to overburden industry with quote-unquote new regulations, so I intentionally put off this mandatory food safety education with a plan that in 1 or 2 years I would go back and have new public hearings to add that into our rules and regulations. So why we're here now.
I mean, we can see some of the logic behind that, trying to get an assessment of where the restaurants were when you were able to first assess them, and knowing that you can't be all things to all people, and certainly there weren't funds to do that. But now as you're going back and saying, okay, if you're going to be in charge of, you know, food prep, at least one employee on every work shift is going to have to be certified as a food handler and be trained in that. What is that training going to entail?
Basically, it's a very simple and basic food safety message that we want to make sure that the person in charge has with regards to running their food establishment. So the food handlers training, we offer the class for free at the Department of Health. Typically, it's a 1 to 2 hour class. And what we're morphing into is because we have only 2 full-time food safety educators in the state, they obviously are not going to be able to rapidly teach. We have 10,000 restaurants with possibly 3 shifts of restaurants at each restaurant. That might mean like 30,000 employees that would need to be certified. So right now, technology is a great thing. There are so many vendors out there that offer online classes to obtain this food handler certificate, and they're offered at very low cost, $10 to $15, and you invest about 1 to 2 hours, and you take an online exam and you get a certificate saying that you have this certain level of food safety knowledge.
Peter, what's your timeline to make sure that all of those people who handle our food are in fact handling them safely?
We haven't discussed that yet, and actually, you know, I can honestly say we're pretty much there now. The placarding program itself, when we first started in 2014, about 30% of our restaurants had yellow cards on their routine inspection. So that means 33% of the restaurants had multiple major violations. As of the last fiscal year, that number has been reduced drastically. We're at about 18% now of our routine inspections with yellow cards. So the program has already been extremely effective in reducing the amount of foodborne illness problems that we see in the field. This, I think, will only increase it more to further reduce the number of critical violations we see. But the restaurant industry as we stand now, the whole placarding program was based on food safety violations. So it clearly demonstrates that the restaurant industry has taken stock into our rules and regulations and have slowly been improving their practice. You know, over 2 years, I didn't expect this kind of result for another, maybe for about 4 years since we started the program. So I'm very happy at the results so far. And this mandatory food safety education will absolutely help that number come down. Yeah.
Good to be pleasantly surprised, too. But there's also the 2013 FDA Model Food Code. You mentioned that we have already been acting under the 2009. Why didn't we update when this other and more recent food code came out?
Yeah, it wasn't published. So we are, as part of this rule right now, we are adopting the 2013 Model Food Code. So one of the big changes as part of this public hearing is we have adopted nearly verbatim the 2013 version. So we are up to date with the rest of the nation if this rule passes.
You know, there are places where we get our food that don't necessarily fall under the heading of restaurant. What about for cottage industry when you go to, you know, farmer's market, other places where you're, in fact, purchasing food, but you're not there in a restaurant? What covers that kind of food?
Yes, they are actually all still regulated by us. In the temporary food world, there are two different classes of foods, and typically they're non-hazardous foods and hazardous foods. The hazardous foods are the things that we concentrate on. These are the types of foods that can spread bacteria or pathogens to other people. The non-hazardous typical type of foods are baked goods. So your traditional bake sale where you have cookies and breads, we have always allowed it to be cooked or prepared in a home kitchen if it was sold directly to the consumer by the person that made it. And the new rule is just codifying it. We had a lot of push from the local food coalitions, Ulupono, I think the Kohala Center, that wanted us to make it more clear what people could do from their homes in this interest of food security and having a more robust food industry and what they cannot. So we have made it very clear as to what type of permits they need if they're serving hazardous foods, and we're actually deregulating the people that want to just do the non-hazardous things from their home kitchens.
You talked a little bit about the non-hazardous, but in terms of the hazardous food that would carry potential bacteria, I'm assuming you're talking about things like maybe, you know, watercress and other greens, those kinds of things, mushrooms, all of that.
No, those are actually all non-hazardous. These are, unless the produce has been cut to be ready to eat in a salad, it's considered a non-hazardous product. So any farmer that just sells heads of lettuce to you can do so without any permit or any restriction. The farmer that wants to do value-added products and turns that lettuce into a bagged salad that's ready to eat, that person needs to do that in a certified kitchen, and they need a permit from us to do that type of operation. So all of it depends on how much you process your food and especially at what point you're going to need that permit. So if you're going to do pork, chicken, beef, those kind of things are automatic. You need a permit for those items. But the line gets a little gray and fuzzy. It's clear for us. But that's why we try to codify it a little bit better in the rules to let people know exactly what they can and cannot sell with a permit, with or without a permit.
And Peter, finally, what about when people gather wild produce? What about that? I mean, we have things growing all over the place, things that are edibles that aren't necessarily farm produced, but you know, people may produce a value added product for that and be selling it at a a bake sale or be able to sell it even at a farmer's market if they're, you know, doing it under the auspice of their farm. What about those things? Do we have to know where those things come from?
No, we don't have to know where the things come from, but the major precaution that everyone has to take, whether you're a restaurant that's buying it from a vendor or whether you're buying it for your own home cooking, is anything that's grown outdoors, you have to make sure to wash thoroughly before use. And just that alone will prevent so many foodborne illnesses by washing produce thoroughly before you eat it. And obviously, cooking any type of thing will, you know, kill any bacteria, but nobody eats cooked salad, right? So you just want to make sure that you know your source. That's very critical also, and to make sure that you wash everything thoroughly before use, and that will stop a lot of the problems we see out there, like the angiostrongyliasis, the rat lungworm diseases, the salmonella on fruits and vegetables. These kinds of things can be a lot mitigated.
That's the good news. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you soon.
Oh, great. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Peter Oshiro is the Environmental Health Program Manager for Sanitation, Food, and Drug Branch of the Department of Health. The last public hearing about the proposed changes to the food safety code happens at 2 o'clock this afternoon in the Lihue Health Center conference room.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:14, and coming up in the show, the Gay Men's Chorus of Honolulu presents its holiday program. But first, your quiz. Today in our backyard quiz, we're going to go outside, even though it may be a little cloudy or raining where you are. We're going to go actually up to the UH Manoa campus and some maybe other parts of Oahu. On the campus and throughout Oahu, you can find the Blaigia sapita trees that have caught the attention of a handful of people in Hawaii. They're known to be related to the lychee and the langan. Then the fruit originated in the tropical Western African countries such as Cameroon, Gabon, and Nigeria. It's since become a Jamaican staple, is their national fruit, and also a key ingredient in many Caribbean dishes. Now, the fruit has a pear shape, and it ripens to a yellow-orange color, splitting open to reveal shiny black seeds. It's also reported to taste like scrambled eggs, but be careful when taking a bite out of one of these because the unripened or inedible portions of the fruit contain several toxins which can induce severe vomiting. I hope you've had breakfast already. Blaigia sapita is the scientific name of the fruit, and for today's backyard quiz, we'd like you to give us the common name. If you think you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We'll have the answer for you later in the show.
It's Festivus for the rest of us. This is Dave Ciano. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
Are you having far too much fun this holiday season? It's a risk the Gay Men's Chorus of Honolulu is willing to take. Its new show is Way Too Merry, a winter concert. It's coming up this weekend, and its executive producer, Butch Meredith, is with us this morning. Good morning, Butch.
Aloha, Chris.
The title of the show, Way Too Merry, implies that it has kind of a whimsical bent. Is that accurate?
Absolutely, and I think especially during the holiday season, the Gay Men's Chorus is known for bringing the whimsical to the Hawaii Theater.
It has kind of, you know, the show has kind of a storyline, it sounds like.
It does. It's somewhat a musical interpretation of the journey of Santa, the anticipation of him arriving and what happens when he gets there, and maybe some things that we don't traditionally consider Santa to be, perhaps angry.
Well, you offer a certain amount of insight into Santa's inner life, yeah?
Absolutely, yeah. We have a portion that talks about his relationship with his wife and how that might go in a very comical and enjoyable sense and how he might feel about it afterwards.
Nobody ever thinks about that. I mean, he's gone a lot, right?
Yeah, he's gone a lot and
in the workshop.
There's obviously a woman behind the man, yeah, and so she should get a little credit every now and then.
So there's you have a song about that.
We do. Served by Santa, and it's performed by one of our guest artists, Tricia Marciel, and it's going to be an amazing, amazing, enjoyable ride for the concert goers.
How many voices have you got now in the
chorus? We currently have 30, which is our largest number yet, and so we're really happy that we continue to grow.
How do you go about recruiting or auditioning? How does one get in?
A lot of it is word of mouth. We do advertise on social media a lot when we have open auditions, and we're pretty loose. We're a very good community-based organization. We don't really say no to people. They come in if they enjoy it. It's a great place for people that are a little shy because there's numbers. There's safety in numbers.
Sure.
We have a lot of people in the military, so military people come and go. And so people that may have had experiences in other city gay men's choruses come looking for us. So we get a lot of outreach that way, too.
Gay men's choruses are a kind of a nationwide phenomenon these days.
Absolutely.
How'd that all come about?
Well, I believe it really happened as a result of a reaction to the Stonewall riots in 1969. The San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus was kind of the first organized group. There were several other markers in history that kind of built that momentum, but they are traditionally the first one. And most metropolitan cities now have gay men's choruses, and it's kind of a mark of a metropolitan city. So we're happy to be it for Honolulu.
Stonewall being often cited as kind of the pivotal moment of the growth of the modern gay rights movement. But having choruses, you know, chorale singing is more in terms of it isn't so much political as a celebration of community, of fellowship, yeah?
Absolutely. Well, I think it's changed over the years. I mean, there's some great male choral music that's deeply rooted in the pains of the AIDS crisis. And there's just some beautiful movements that have led to creation of music for gay men's choruses. But now I think it's a lot more of a celebration of how far we've come and the diversity of the LGBTQ community, as well as celebrations of love and things that we haven't really been able to express in the past.
What is that growing diversity? How did that come about?
Well, I definitely think that over the past few years, there's been a lot more awareness of, say, transgender, gay marriage rights. There's a lot more. I do think gay kind of is the prevalent but it really is the LGBTQ movement. And I think more awareness of these different communities and people identifying themselves as the way they want to be identified and their freedom of expression as a result of that, us honoring that and believing in it and supporting it and embracing it is definitely a part of what we do.
You can kind of see how a movement evolves in terms of going from being very much, you know, sticking with those like oneself to kind of moving out into a larger community, finding commonality. Is that kind of what this progression has been?
I definitely think so. And even amongst the members of the chorus themselves, I mean, we call ourselves a gay men's chorus, but we do have a straight member. We've had a lot of members in the military since Don't Ask, Don't Tell has gone away. There's a lot more freedom there for them to participate. We've had a trans member be part of our chorus. So I think the chorus itself even shows the diversity that we're embracing and trying to be a part of.
As the members, you know, sort of interact with one another aside from in the music, do you feel that you're learning, for instance, about what it's like to be gay in the military today?
Oh, I definitely think so. I think that we have opportunity and fellowship to learn, ask questions and learn really about each other. I mean, I'm a father of two children, and not a lot of the people in the chorus are parents. And so they get to see me act as a gay parent. What does that look like? How does that work in the world that we live in? So I think we definitely share each other's lives and experiences that way.
I'm sure some of those experiences have to do with feeling somewhat beleaguered in the gay world as well, right?
I mean,
at least in the past.
Yeah, certainly in the past, and you know, I think there's some trepidation about the future, what the future is going to bring with the transition of government. But I do believe that we are stronger together, and we all have each other's backs as a way of looking at it. So. We've overcome so much to get where we are. I have every faith and belief that it won't change.
So when it comes to putting together a show, you kind of put all the everything aside except the kind of celebratory spirit, I would think.
I think so. And I think it's important to not be too, you know, mired in fear. You know, we need to bring happiness and joy and, you know, a camp. We bring a lot of camp to the Hawaii Theater. And it's enjoyable. And, you know, we have some people that are really conservative in our choir that come and they want to sing their music and be a part of it. And then we have some that are really, like, full-on entertainers. And they want to be up on stage dancing and singing and full of costumes and joy. And that's what we bring all that to the Hawaii Theater and to the people that are participants in the chorus.
Well, I love the name, Way Too Merry. I mean, that says it all right there, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's great. And we have an actual play on the word too. So we initially did Way Too Merry, like this is the path towards being merry. And then we added the T-O-O on the posters, say, you know, we are just way too fun.
Yeah, well, we want to keep that under control.
No, we should always have fun.
That's right, Brooks. Thanks a lot. Good talking to you.
You as well.
Butch Meredith is the president, chairman of the board, co-founder, and executive producer of the Gay Men's Chorus of Honolulu, which is presenting Way Too Merry, a winter concert, Sunday at the Hawaii Theater in Honolulu. And you can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Yeah, you better watch out. You better not cry. You better not pout. I'm telling you why. Say.
Hawaii Public Radio gratefully acknowledges Lillian Jones of Honolulu, Stephen Matadobra of Kaneohe, and Andrea Thayer of Kihei for their recent membership gifts. Thank you to all of our listeners for your support.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Kaiser Permanente and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
A question for this morning: should union members be able to disobey a smoking ban? One union says that hospital administrators started following the law without consulting its members, and that violated collective bargaining agreements. Civil Beat's Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Okay, so you know that there's a smoking ban law. We've been hearing about that for a long time. How can it be that anyone can be questioning whether or not that can be enforced?
Well, this particular law is new. The legislature just passed it this past session, called Act 25, and it applies only to the Hawaii Health Systems Corporation. Now, that's 12 hospitals across the state of Hawaii. That includes the one on Maui, Maui Regional, Leahi Hospital here on Oahu. And so instead of allowing people to smoke on premises, this new law requires them to walk off premises. You have to actually leave the campus in order to light up a cigarette or an e-smoking device. The reason for this is because, well, lawmakers think it's important to take care of the health of those workers, but also patients at the hospital and visitors. But UPW, the union that has a lot of workers at the health systems hospitals, says you're violating our collective bargaining. You did not come to us to talk about this. Therefore, this law essentially is null and void until we work something out.
So what does the head of the Hawaii Health Systems Corp say? What does Dr. Linda Rosen say?
Well, she's very disappointed by this whole thing. She says, look, I'm merely implementing the law. I was required to do this by the legislature. This issue went to the Hawaii Labor Relations Board, which sided with the union. Now Rosen and HHSC are taking their case to the First Circuit Court. In fact, she's argued all along that's really where this should be decided. That's the jurisdiction, not a labor board. This is actually a state law that must be addressed by a judge.
And you're talking about, you know, a health issue that even for everybody else that we've had for quite a while, where people cannot smoke by entrances to buildings, that they have to be able to go at least 20 feet away, all of that, we've been dealing with that for quite a while. This seems to be a furthering of that, but one that doesn't seem to have a clear-cut answer. Is this, in fact, going to have to go to court?
I think there's a very good chance, unless they can somehow settle this. It has already been appealed to court, whether the court accepts the case is pending, whether the labor board with the union and the hospital can negotiate this. We'll have to see. But there seems to be no communication back and forth that's satisfactory. By the way, UPW did not return our calls. They aren't talking to us. But we can tell you that Josh Green, one of the authors of the bill, says, look, this is not about smoking breaks. This is about taking care of people's health.
Because you're talking about people who may be medically fragile, vulnerable, people coming in and out to visit them, too, and looking after the health and well-being of all. I mean, I seem to think that's what you're driving at here. But for the interim time where this is, you know, clearly not going to be decided, will the hospital continue to follow the law?
From what I'm told so far, people have been complying with the law. They've been walking off premises. Nobody has actually violated it. Nobody's lit up a cigarette there on campus, as far as the hospital officials know. But it's hard to track. There's 12 hospitals, mind you, across the state. But even Josh Green said he works at one of those hospitals on the Big Island. He says, yep, they got to walk off. And he sees them because that's what the law says.
All right. Well, we'll continue to see what happens with this. Clearly, it's not over. Thanks, Chad. Have a good weekend. And we will talk to you on Monday morning.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check. It's a Friday, and as we always like to do, as we're finishing a week, we like to look ahead to what's coming in the following week. And then we've got Bill Dorman, HPR's news director, to do just that. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So next week, here we are, we're going to be dealing with yet another issue concerning homelessness. What's going on with the Interagency Council?
Yeah, exactly. So they are meeting next week, getting a bit of an update on some of the work that they've been doing. As you know, Scott Morshia chairs this group. It's under the Department of Human Services, but the idea is to bring together and focus some of the efforts towards homelessness. Public meeting of the group, by the way, so if folks are interested, that's going to be on Monday at the Honolulu Inter-Island Terminal. But it's also not just Oahu-focused. There is input and there are updates in terms of neighbor island situations as well. So Wayne Yoshioka is going to be covering it for us. Give us a sense of the meeting and also short-term outlook in terms of homelessness. They're looking in terms of the agenda as well. Some material from point in time count of this year, and also looking ahead to next year's on that.
And that point in time count having, you know, aged quite a bit now, really looking at what kind of information do we rely on from that as opposed to what's coming in about a month or so. But the outreach workers who are there, they have a keen sense of what's going on. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of this meeting.
And that's exactly right. I mean, as you and I both sort of focus on as we go through, it's such a moving target in different directions. And it's not just a matter of overall numbers. That's part of the story. But there's so many threads to this in terms of placement, in terms of what is happening on the ground. And that does move quickly, as you said.
All right. That's one thing we'll look forward to next week. What about what's going on the Big Island with girls and STEM?
Yeah, well, this is a great story. Girls Exploring Math and Science, GEMS, actually. It's a national program. It goes through the AAUW, American Association of University Women. But as with so many national programs, it's tricky in terms of how it's applied locally. And on the Big Island, they've done this in a way. There's a program involving more than 300 girls, private schools, public schools, homeschooled folks, and bringing this together. Sherry Bracken's working on a nice piece about that that's going to give a little more perspective on the background of this and what it's doing.
And, Bill, what ages of girls are we talking about?
young through
middle school, high school.
I believe it's younger and then through mid school. Yeah.
So even younger than we usually hear about being targeted. Interesting. Okay. It's still the holidays, though, you know, with all of this, and we're seeing lights and neighbors doing all kinds of things. And
it is indeed.
We need some holiday flavor here.
Well, Noitani Gao is going to bring a little holiday flavor. Part of that, of course, on lights. Where have we come from on lights? There have been so many light shows going on. Christmas displays used to be handmade. The digitization of this has changed so much of life in other areas, but it's also changed Christmas lights. And
don't we know
it? Yeah, and sort of what that means, what they look like, and what if you're a fan of the light shows, what you can look forward to a little bit of coming this holiday season.
They're great, except when your neighbors forget to turn them off and it's 11 o'clock at night. That's not so fun.
Sounds like a voice of experiencer.
Well, I'm not the offending party, but that's okay. Anyway, it's a nice holiday thing. It only happens once a year, so we can enjoy it as we can. Anything else that you know coming through?
Just quickly, Maui next week, end of sugar. HCNS, their last harvest comes in. Alexander and Baldwin now a focus again to water rights in East Maui.
Exactly, that ongoing issue.
And Molly Solomon's going to be on that.
Good. Well, we'll look forward to all of that and even more.
You bet.
Coming out of HPR's news department. And now at 8:36, we'll be back with you in just a second. Many educators were very happy to see the federal directive No Child Left Behind itself get left behind last year when President Obama signed the Every Student Succeeds Act. The ESSA gives more control over school systems to the states. Since last summer, Governor Ige's ESSA team has held statewide meetings to gather public input. What emerged as a blueprint for a long-term plan for Hawaii schools was presented this week to the state's Board of Education. Daryl Calera led the governor's team and now also sits on the BOE. He joins us now. Good morning. Good to see you again.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Great to be back.
It seems that, you know, if there's a thematic part to this, that it would be the shift from mandates to school empowerment. We've kind of seen that in past, but not specifically in this way. So how, just as a way of getting into this conversation a little bit, what makes this different from other school-based, you know, management or empowerment that we've seen in the past?
I think the vision, Beth Ann, is that we're really going to have a systemic approach to empowering schools, and with that, empowering students and teachers and principals and entire communities. For when we empower the schools, we expect what will unleash is just a wave of innovation, as compared to what you just described being the restrictions of No Child Left Behind. Empowerment requires a great deal of things. It requires the conditions to let that happen. It requires a lot of transparency in terms of if principals and teachers and schools need to make decisions about things, they need the information so they can make these informed decisions. So there'll be a great change from the federal law in terms of the new level of transparency that's required.
That also seems to suggest a greater sensitivity to a school's community.
Very much so.
And even though we've kind of had that in the old SCBM movement, how do you think this is different from that?
I think we our hope is we're going to be much more intentional and have a much deeper understanding of how to engage and work with our communities. We've been looking at some of the leading or cutting-edge types of approaches in terms of community engagement. And we think that if we can start taking full advantage of this through all of our schools and our principals and our teachers, that I think we'll see a big difference.
What does that look like?
Well, you know, I'll share a good example that in our state libraries, they've actually, you know, our state librarian, Stacey Aldrich, has already had some of her state librarians trained in how to engage communities using what we're referring to as a public innovators approach, and how we focus on turning outward to communities instead of, when we have challenges, turning inward and trying to, you know, figure out how to technically solve problems. We realize that we're in a very adaptive world, and sometimes trying to apply technical solutions to an adaptive problem just doesn't work. And so we need to be able to turn out and take full advantage of everyone in our communities and work in partnership. And that's part of the excitement, I think.
All of that said, we're also being told that this is to create, or at least foster, greater innovation and to prepare the children who are being taught to be part of an innovative world where, you know, things don't fit neatly into little boxes, and where jobs and roles and the way in which we interact with each other will be changing. How does this begin to approach that when there's so much that we don't know, without suggesting that, you know, simply this is a matter of maintaining that openness, flexibility, and understanding that things are changing even as a plan may be formed?
Mm-hmm. We think it starts first in the classroom and directly with our teachers and our students. And we can start teaching our students to be even more thoughtful about how to approach innovation and creativity very intentionally. We have some great approaches. You may have heard of design thinking is one approach where students learn how to, you know, begin with empathy for trying to look at how to create ideas and find prototypes and solutions for problems. We have it happening in great places already across the state, and we think that's just an example of how the teaching and the learning will start to change, and will be more focused on, you know, teaching students to be successful for what will be truly an innovation-driven economy in the future.
Design thinking also brings with it a lot of collaboration.
Very much.
And in the way in which we learn how to work with each other, there's also the issue of how kids remain competitive. That making that balance of how they're prepared to do well individually, but also to be able to work in teams. How does the ESSA team's approach to a long-term plan for Hawaii begin to address that, when that, too, is going to be shifting?
You know, one of the focuses that, and you can see it in the blueprint, is, you know, in how we will achieve equity in Hawaii. And we're defining equity not in terms of everyone having the same amount of funding or anything, but in terms of we need to provide the opportunities for all of our students to be successful. And so but we have a huge achievement gap in Hawaii. It's been getting worse in some ways. So it needs to be a focus where we're going to be very intentional and focused on how we will provide the new support so all of our students can be successful. So it's a big change that we're looking at.
If the blueprint is sort of, you know, the what is going to happen over a longer period of time, and as has been suggested, the BOE strategic plan is more the how, there has been some discussion about how do you get to the how if you don't understand the what and why these things were developed separately. They've now come back together, but how do you address that so that there wasn't a, you know, not just perhaps redundancy, but parts that were left out that would be important for each to know about the other?
You know, I think it was in some ways a challenge, but it was also a huge opportunity that with the new law and the new attention on the changes in education, that we were able to have so many working concurrently on coming up with a vision document like the blueprint, and again a strategic plan to make it real. I think we need to continue that kind of collaboration, because we still have much more work to do, not only with the DOE's strategic plan, but the blueprint is actually something that has to bring together all of the state plans. So from the early learning office, from the Department of Labor, from throughout the entire state, all of the various plans have to come together.
Daryl, I think we need to pull together a town square so we can have a much longer discussion about this, because we're just beginning to get into some of the differences here and how they feed into a more unified plan. Thank you, though, for coming in this morning.
Thank you, Bethann.
Daryl Galera is a former public school teacher and principal who was appointed by Governor Ige to the Board of Education in October. He's the school leadership consultant and coach for the Hawaii Center for Instructional Leadership. He's also currently serving as the chairman of the governor's ESSA team.
Aloha, I'm Brady Evans from Honolulu. You're tuned to HBR2 Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. I've met a lot of folks who think technology is a product of modern times. But think about it. The ancient Polynesians' ability to design ocean-going va'a, upon which they sailed around the Pacific Ocean using the stars to navigate, was high-tech back in those days. It still is. Pacific Islanders have long been at the forefront of science and technology, and this continues right through today, for there is a strong focus of ensuring our future workforce has the tools to operate in the 21st century. With support from the Think Fund at the Hawaii Community Foundation, established by the 30-meter telescope along with 8 other funders, the STEM Learning Partnership was created. Its mission was to prepare Hawaii Island kids for STEM-related careers. The plan has reached more than 5,000 students, and it appears to be on target. 2 students, Courtney Nelson and Josiah Clark, even worked on a NASA-funded project that will be sent to the moon. That's right, their project will go to the moon. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
Earlier in the week, earlier in the show, we were looking at Bligia sapida, the African fruit that is a member of the Sapindaceae soapberry family, as are the lychee and the longan. It's not cultivated or commercialized in the U.S. because if it's picked or cooked improperly, it can be very deadly. The ripened fruit is a delicacy in Jamaican culture, but they're very careful in handling and cooking the fruit because of the natural toxin called hypoglycin A. It's also the Caribbean island's national fruit and part of their national dish when paired with saltfish. Earlier, we asked you to give us the common name for the bright reddish fruit that caught our attention, and that would be aki.
And Kylie Kosaka knew it, called in from Lihue, and will be receiving today's prize. If you've got a backyard quiz for us, you can always send it in to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Noheya Gallery and Straub Clinic and Hospital.
Toshiro Mifune is one of the great heroic actors in cinema, able to transform himself into a warrior, a king, a crazy loner, or a compassionate doctor without ever descending into caricature. If his characters have a unifying trait, it's their complexity. There's always something going on behind the eyes, and the viewer can't take his eyes off him. Stephen Okazaki is the director of Mifune, The Last Samurai, a documentary that will be screened tonight in Honolulu, and he's on the line with us now. Good morning, Stephen.
Morning, Chris.
When I describe him as a heroic actor, I'm kind of thinking that he's not the person you want to be of secondary interest in the scene. He's usually the primary interest in the scene because you can't pay that much attention to any other actor when he's on the screen. Do you agree?
It's hard to imagine him as the sidekick, certainly. And although he's quite good at playing these character roles of playing older men and I guess in Seven Samurai, he's certainly riveting every time he gets on screen, but he does very well in an ensemble setting.
We first meet him, most Westerners first met him in Rashomon. And, you know, he's a bandit, he's a criminal, and yet there's something. We see him, obviously, in several different ways in the course of that film, but it reinforces the kind of multidimensional quality that I think all his characters seem to have.
Well, Rashomon is special. I mean, I remember the first time I saw it, I was rather frightened by it. I mean, he's so menacing in that film, and childlike at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. There's a menacing but innocent in an odd way, right?
Yeah, I mean, as we see in the film, that menace, though, I think is really striking in that film. Scorsese notes that he studied the movements of wild animals, wild lions and tigers in the zoo to prepare for the film.
Well, he moves around in the frame as if it were a cage in that film.
Yes, absolutely.
Did he have any kind of, what kind of training did he bring to this? Because that almost makes it seem as if he'd had dance training or some, you know, pretty advanced training in physical acting.
Well, as you see in the film, I mean, he got into Toho Studios hoping to be a camera assistant. And somehow his resume went over to the actors department, and they had a big competition. And it seems like, you know, there was at Toho, there was a burst of energy after the war, and young people, you know, actors, cameramen, you know, makeup people, they were all sort of roughly the same age, and they're, you know, between 20 and 30.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of people coming in, and so there was training, you know, there was voice training and dance training, but Mifune, my impression is, you know, he really defined, you know, worked on his character and developed them himself. He was very proud that he never brought his script to on location the first day of shooting. He would have everything memorized, but he had thought it through, you know, seriously. We looked at his script notes, and he had, you know, red pen markings throughout the script, you know, just little tiny things, you know, just step here, pause here. He was always, he was very prepared actor. I mean, the other actors talk about sort of being intimidated that he was, you know, on set, on time, every time, even if he had a hangover.
Mm-hmm. One of these actors who kind of knows everybody's lines in addition to his own, and really has an overarching view of his script and the place in it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I saw the films, of course, you know, like many people, you know, when I was a kid, and then when I was in college, and doing this film, you know, I really came to appreciate just how good. What a wonderful, versatile actor he was, and just how ambitious the Kurosawa films were, and sort of they had, you know, what a perfect match they were for each other. They could, you know, Kurosawa could use his, you know, Mifune's dynamism, and Mifune found the perfect vehicle in these Kurosawa films.
For me, I saw one of the first American screenings of Red Beard way back in the day, and to me, it's the culmination of that whole Kurosawa Toshirô Mifune relationship. That's a film that's too little seen, isn't it?
Red Beard. It's a very different film. Mifune plays a country doctor at the sort of end of the Edo period in Japan, and. But, you know, they do throw in a fight scene, you know, in the latter part of the film where Mifune takes out, I think, about 8 or 9 bad guys.
Yeah.
But without a sword, though. It's some sort of, you know, martial arts thing that they, sort of uniquely his, that they you know, sort of worked on for the film. But, yeah, Redbeard, I mean, is, you know, he plays a very, you know, very different character. You do sense, though, that he's sort of being a bit pushed aside. He's not really the star of Redbeard. The star of the Redbeard is the young doctor who's, and you feel like he's being groomed to take, you know, take the lead in the next film.
Well, he's not the star, but he's inevitably kind of the anchor of that film, and that's that quality he has that's, you know, the overworked term star quality, where you have to know what he's doing next, what he's thinking. Yeah.
Well, I think Steven Spielberg's in the film, and he just talks about his, you know, his presence, even when he's not saying anything, even when, you know, he's just staring at the camera, and how that influenced so many actors in the 1960s. And, you know, I was watching a Paul Newman film recently, and I realized how Mifune-esque Newman was. You watch Bruce Willis, you know, clearly.
And, sure.
Clint Eastwood, certainly.
Well, one of Newman's first roles was a remake of Rashomon, yeah? Outrage.
Right, right. It's just hard to, you know, I think, you know, we think of those films as back then, but they certainly, you know, they've influenced films that we're seeing these days, even, you know.
Very much so. Stephen, thanks very much for talking with us.
Great talk.
Good luck with your film.
Thank you. Come see it.
All right. Stephen Okazaki is the director of Mifune, The Last Samurai, a documentary that will be screened tonight at 7:30 at Consolidated Theaters in Kahala. And a Q&A session with Toshiro Mifune's grandson, Rikia Mifune, will follow the screening.
We spent so much time talking this morning, we don't have a whole lot of time to talk before we have to say goodbye for the weekend.
That's all to the good sometimes.
Well, you know, there's just a lot of stuff to talk about, and we'll continue to do that. You know, nice to have a little bit of the holiday input there, too.
That's so right. We're seeing
not
more
forgetting
and more,
about that.
More and more holiday celebrations.
And we'll have some more musical celebrations.
That's right.
As we move through the rest of the month. Meantime, coming on Monday, we're going to talk with human rights attorney Robin Gronin about the Climate Displacement Migration and Relocation Symposium happening next week.
And we're going to have some more holiday music from the multi-talented Willow Chang.
In the meantime, if you want to be in touch, there are lots of ways to do that. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. And you can tweet us at HI Conversation or tweet me at BKOZHPR.
If you've ever wondered about the music you hear on the show, you can find the playlist on our page at HawaiiPublicRadio.org, where you can also listen back to today's show. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Russell Subiono are our production assistants.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you on Monday when we pick up the conversation. Enjoy the weekend.